This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Welcome back to our Not Completely Unknown series, which presents something of a newbie's guide to Bob Dylan's life and work. Today we have the debut of a brand new podcast. It's the first episode of Dylan Revisited by Colm Larkin. Today we have the debut of a brand new podcast, the first episode of Dylan Revisited by Colm Larkin. This began as a series of tweets in which Colm would tell the story of one Dylan record or an event, both concisely as tweets require, but also compellingly. Later he turned these into blog posts on the Dylan FM Substack, and now they've become a podcast. As you'll hear, it's a fantastic way to take in and appreciate his skill in researching and producing these little vignettes of key moments in Bob's career. We start today at the beginning, in terms of records anyway, with his Columbia debut, an event very much featured in the new movie A Complete Unknown, where we get a visual image of what it was like inside Columbia Studios at 799 7th Avenue in November of 1961. The building they stood in, by the way, was demolished in 1983, and if you visit now, you'll find a huge 54-floor skyscraper on the east side of 7th Avenue between 51st and 52nd Street. But the original album remains, and despite its initial failure, you can find it on any streaming service or on MoFi Super Vinyl for about $60. It's a great record to go back and listen to in light of everything that has happened since, especially now while we're all focused back on the beginning. So let's hear about that record and that time on the debut edition of Dylan Revisited by Colm Larkin.
Welcome to Dylan Revisited, the podcast that revisits Bob Dylan's back catalogue, one album, bootleg, live show, single, film, and more at a time. My name is Colm Larkin, your host for these revisits, and today we're starting our journey back where it all began in 1962. Let's revisit Bob Dylan's self-titled debut album. When I look at the photograph on the front cover of Bob Dylan's debut album, I wonder, who is this guy? I don't recognise the baby-fattened, cap-wearing troubadour staring at me with those soft eyes and hint of a smile. That cherubic countenance is far from the scowling, pinched presence that will become so iconic in the years to come. Of course, his name is right there in the bold red letters that separate that unfamiliar face from the neck of his guitar. It's Bob Dylan. This is his self-titled debut album. His introduction to the world. Yet, it's a highly un-Bob Dylan record. For a start, the world's most renowned songwriter only composed two of his debut record's 13 songs. Then there's his voice. Instead of that familiar nasal wavering whine that we all love to imitate, on this album Dylan often sings in a grating, grizzled voice. But the most un-Dylan thing about this record is that few people at the time cared about it. Bob Dylan's debut only sold 2,500 copies during its initial 1962 release. While some were put off by unenthusiastic reviews, most people were simply unaware of its existence. No Dylan after this would ever be met with such indifference. Even his deliberate acts of sabotage like Self-Portrait, the much-derided Christian Era, and his late career crooning were greeted by loud critical pearl-clutching, best summed up by the opening line of Grail Marcus's infamous Self-Portrait review, "What is this shit?" However, that disgust disguised as a question is a harsh starting point for looking back at Bob Dylan's debut album. So instead, let's go back to what I asked earlier when looking at the cover. Who is this guy? It's a question that most listeners of the album back in 1962 would have needed answering. Dylan wasn't well known outside of the small Greenwich Village folk circuit, most of who tended to call him Bobby. Even his family and friends back home in Minnesota may have struggled to reconcile the name on the cover with the face of their son, brother and schoolmate, Robert Zimmerman. The only significant suggestion that Bob Dylan was worth your attention was a New York Times live review by its music correspondent Robert Shelton of a show at Gurley's Folk City in Greenwich Village. Calling Dylan a bright new face in folk music and a distinctive stylist, Shelton turned the supporting performer on that mid-September evening in 1961 into the headline act of his review. The legend goes that the glowing New York Times write-up caught the eye of Columbia Records executive John Hammond, who had given Billie Holiday and Count Basie their first big breaks and would go on to sign Leonard Cohen and Bruce Springsteen. However, Hammond had already met Dylan 2 weeks earlier when the singer was playing harmonica at a rehearsal session for Columbia artist Carolyn Hester. Hammond liked Dylan straight away and was ready to offer the singer a contract on the same day that Shelton's review was printed. In that Times write-up, the critic had also wondered who Dylan was, stating that the singer was vague about his antecedents and birthplace. Around this time, Dylan had a habit of enhancing, exaggerating, and even outright inventing the details of his past, including his name. Perhaps this uncertainty about his own identity contributed to the crisis of confidence that seemed to affect the 21-year-old Dylan once he'd finally secured a record deal, after months of gigging for tips in Greenwich Village's basket houses and cafes. Rather than simply refine and record the material he had been playing live so far, Dylan spent 2 manic weeks seeking out new songs. This largely involved rifling through the record collections of friends and acquaintances, often pilfering the ones that caught his ear. He was similarly light-fingered when it came to his fellow musicians, especially in the case of his sometime mentor, Dave Van Ronk. A major figure in the village folk scene, known as the Mayor of MacDougall Street, Van Ronk often let Dylan stay in his apartment and taught him songs. One of these was his own arrangement of the traditional blues tune, House of the Rising Sun. When Dylan asked Van Ronk if he could use it for his debut, Van Ronk replied that he had plans to record it himself. But Dylan wasn't asking for permission, he was begging for forgiveness, having already cut the track for Columbia.
There's a house down in New Orleans. They call the rising sun, and it's been the ruin of many poor girls and me. Oh God, I'm a one.
At least House of the Rising Sun was a song that Dylan knew well. He recorded the gospel blues In My Time of Dying, having never played it before entering Columbia's Studio A in New York City. And once was enough for the singer, who refused a second take, as he did with at least 4 other tracks recorded for the album over 3 days. Dylan was okay with an imperfect recording if the overall feel of the song was right. But this approach infuriated producer Hammond, who was also exasperated by the singer's lack of studio experience. Hammond complained that Dylan was always either wandering away from the mic or popping his peas and, worst of all, never learned from his mistakes. Then there's that over-the-top growl Dylan adopts on In My Time of Dying and other songs, including the traditional spiritual Gospel Plough and bluesman Bucca White's Fixing to Die. In his Times review, Robert Shelton had praised the singer for how all the husk and bark are left on his notes. On this record, it sounds like Dylan increased the crust on his vocals even further. If he was trying to sound more like the old bluesmen whose songs he was singing, the results are somewhat inauthentic. It's telling that he never returned to that vocal style, or even those songs he sang using it, with the exception of a couple of live performances in 1962 and 63 of Highway 51 Blues. That song was originally written by blues pianist Curtis Jones, and Dylan will reference his title a few years later on his seminal rock record, Highway 61 Revisited.
Highway 51 runs right by my baby's door. Highway 51 runs right by my baby's door. I don't get the gal I'm loving. Walk down, I weigh 51 no more.
Dylan's voice on Man of Constant Sorrow is more natural and the song is better for it. It's also notable for his changing the line, "Your friends say I'm a stranger," to "Your mother says I'm a stranger." This is potentially a first reference to his then-girlfriend Suze Rotolo, who was in the studio during recording. Dylan used her lipstick holder to play slide guitar on In My Time of Dying. Suze will become the topic of a number of Dylan's upcoming classic compositions like Don't Think Twice It's All Right and Boots of Spanish Leather. And her mother, who was never a great fan of her daughter's boyfriend, would get another mention on a Dylan song 2 years later, that bitter document of his and Suze's breakup, Ballad in Plain D. Bob Dylan's debut album opens with the slight and annoying You're No Good, a cover of a song by Jesse Fuller. That Georgia-born blues musician played guitar, harmonica, kazoo, percussion and bass all at the same time. Apparently Dylan picked up the idea of using a harmonica brace from this one-man band. After You're No Good comes the first official record of a Bob Dylan original.
Rambling out of the Wild West, leaving the towns I love the best. Thought I'd seen some ups and downs till I came into New York town. People going down to the ground, buildings going up to the sky.
Talking New York is a light-hearted account of Dylan's own journey to the big city from what in the song he calls the Wild West, but we really know was the Midwest. He doesn't quit with that self-mythologizing, does he? Dylan delights in playing the wide-eyed rube in this song. He's astounded by the skyscrapers, scams and snow, and you can almost hear him wink when he pronounces the neighborhood at the center of the folk scene as Greenwich Village. He also takes real pride in his music being dismissed as hillbilly by an unimpressed coffeehouse owner who tells him, "We want folk singers here." But Talking New York's rambling jokes mostly fall flat on record, especially when compared to the live versions of him playing the song at various Greenwich Village venues around this time. I find that the talking blues format often loses something when you can't hear the audience's laughter and other reactions.
Houses on the block, but I'd get on the stage, sing and play, man, there, shaking back some other day, sound like a hillbilly. We're looking for folk singers around here.
After the growling trifecta of death and sorrow that features In My Time of Dying, Man of Constant Sorrow, and Fixing to Die, Pretty Peggio brings us back to the upbeat, rollicking style of the opening two songs. This American traditional based on a Scottish ballad is one that Dylan returned to a lot for his live shows during the 1990s. Overall, the first half of Bob Dylan's debut album is surprisingly average. It's hard to imagine listeners from 1962 being blown away so far. But, nine songs in, we finally hear something great.
Baby, let me follow you down. Baby, let me follow you down. Well, I'd do anything in this God Almighty world if you just let me follow you down.
Baby Let Me Follow You Down starts with a breezy acknowledgement of the song's original arranger, Eric von Schmidt, and takes a playful jab at folk purists who wouldn't have seen the green pastures of Harvard University as fertile soil for authentic folk music. In this relaxed but engaging performance, Dylan's voice bears little affectation, and both his guitar playing and harmonica interludes are lovely. In a few years, he'll mischievously turn this genial folk song into a riotous rock number for another, much more combative dig at the folkerati, during his infamous electric tour. Song to Woody is the album's second original and one of the first songs Bob Dylan wrote. Up to this point, he hadn't really considered himself to be a songwriter, but suddenly felt that no one else could write what he needed to say, a literal and symbolic farewell to his hero, Woody Guthrie. Dylan spent years learning Guthrie songs, aped his look, and regularly visited the folk legend in the New Jersey hospital where he was living out his final years while debilitated by Huntington's disease. Song to Woody's music is based on Guthrie's 1913 massacre, while also referencing lyrics from some of his other songs, including Hard Travelling and Passages of Plenty. A line from the latter, "We come with the dust and we go with the wind," is directly invoked by Dylan in Song to Woody.
Here's to Cisco and Sonny and a lead belly too, and to all the good people that traveled with you. Here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind.
An early Dylan masterpiece, Song to Woody is a fine tribute to Woody Guthrie, but also the songwriter's way of moving on. After this, his regular visits to Guthrie and hospital ceased, and different Dylan personalities began to supersede his impression of Woody. Before that important moment on the record is the much more disposable Freight Train Blues, the last song recorded for the album. Dylan likely heard this via country singer Roy Acuff, and he sounds like he's having fun delivering the song at breakneck speed, pausing only to sustain a yodel for a remarkably long time.
Well, my daddy was a fireman and my mama, yeah, she was the only daughter of the engineer. My sweetheart loved a brakeman and it ain't no joke, it's a shame the way she keeps a good man broke. I got the freight train blues.
Bob Dylan's debut album closes with Blind Lemon Jefferson's "See That My Grave Is Kept Clean," a song that Shelton called out in his Gurdy's review. This is the best of the record's bluesy, growly stuff and features some excellent guitar playing from Dylan.
Well, there's one kind of favor I'll ask of you. Well, there's one kind of favor I'll ask of you. There's just one kind of favor I'll ask of you. You can't see that my grave is kept clean.
Revisiting Bob Dylan's 1962 debut album today is largely an underwhelming experience. Would the record have been improved if he had included some of the songs he also recorded at the time but eventually decided weren't right for the final tracklist? The outtakes from the three short studio sessions include a great take on the Scottish standard House Carpenter. Dylan introduces the song as the story of a ghost coming out of the sea and proceeds to tell his tale with great intensity and rhythm. Dylan also delivers an achingly sad version of He Was a Friend of Mine. Like Baby Let Me Follow You Down, this is based on an Eric von Schmidt arrangement, so maybe he didn't want two of these on his record. Dave Van Ronk would later record that song and miscredit Dylan, the man who appropriated his arrangement of House of the Rising Sun, as its writer. Man on the Street is another Dylan original, though like Song to Woody, it leans heavily on traditional melodies and words. The lyrics, about seeing a homeless man dead on the street, are an early herald of the slew of socially minded topical songs that will soon come pouring out of Dylan.
Well, I sing you a song, it ain't very long, about an old man he never done wrong. How he died nobody can say, they found him dead in the street one day. Well, a crowd gathered one fine morn at the man whose clothes and shoes were torn. There on the sidewalk he did lay, they stopped and stared and they went their way.
Each of these three outtakes seems much more in the mould of the Bob Dylan to come, but he rejected them in favour of gritty, death-obsessed blues numbers. This was also around the time he told people that he rode the rails down south and worked in carnivals. He was committing to the blues mythos. Dylan would later say that he didn't want to give away too much of himself on the record. His studio stubbornness and raw performances of minor standards suggest a wariness about his major label trying to polish him into something more palatable. His obstinacy worked, as Bob Dylan's debut album was not a commercial success. Neither were the critics impressed, though hats off to the Billboard reviewer who astutely suggested that Dylan, when he finds his own style, could win a big following. In Martin Scorsese's brilliant documentary, No Direction Home, Dylan recalled his thoughts on hearing the finished record.
When I got the disc, I played it and I was highly disturbed. I just wanted to cross this record out and make another record immediately. I thought I'd recorded the wrong songs and I'd already written a few of my own maybe that I thought maybe I should have stuck on there. I was way past that record. Or part of me was just saying that I didn't want to record that record anyway, that I just did it. I didn't want to give away anything that was, you know, dear to me or something.
A month after the release of his debut album in March 1962, Bob Dylan was back in the studio, working on the Freewheeling, where he would find his own voice and confirm Shelton's view that he had the mark of originality. The album that kickstarted a 6-decade-long career, the one that bears his name, was not really Bob Dylan.
I'm going back to Colorado, place that I started from. If I'd known how bad you treat me, honey, I never would have come.
What do you think of Bob Dylan's self-titled debut album? Does it stand up today as a record worth revisiting, or is it merely a curiosity that preludes the greater works to come? Let me know your thoughts by getting in touch on Twitter, or X if you must. You'll find me at Dylan Revisited there. Or you can email the show at dylanrevisitedpod@gmail.com. That's it for the very first episode of the Dylan Revisited podcast. Thank you very much for listening. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Good feedback can help the show reach new Dylan fans, so whatever you can do to help spread the word will be appreciated. On the next episode of Dylan Revisited, I'll be going back to 1961 to the bootleg recording of a live Dylan performance at New York's Gaslight Cafe. This predates the recording of his debut album and is a fascinating insight into what other songs he was playing around this time. I'll also revisit a pair of shows at the same venue a year later, in October 1962, 6 months on from his debut release, where a more familiar Bob Dylan is starting to take shape. I hope you can join me to revisit Bob Dylan at the Gaslight. Talk to you then.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. Also, sign up for 7 Days, our free weekly newsletter that puts all the top Bob Dylan news and links into your inbox every Sunday. Use the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening.